visionary museums to display. You know what artists make, I'm just a friend of a friend of a friend of someone with taste.
Today is Monday, June 6, 2011. I'm Iqbal Ahmed.
And I'm Martin Lemlin. This is CITR News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Good evening. It's 5:04 p.m. and time for a full hour of independent news. Today we're going to provide in-depth coverage of the new Conservative budget and have an interview with UBC professor and Dr. Brent Finley on the recent E. coli outbreak in Germany and an interview with Robert Holmes about the new BC Poverty Reduction Plan, as well as FSRN headlines. All this plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent, local, national, and international news.
But first, headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
Nell Abram with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Dozens of Bahraini doctors and nurses were arraigned in a military court today, charged with various counts of helping the anti-government movement. But supporters say they simply provided emergency medical care and spoke to media. Yesterday, the Iraqi Coast Guard blocked a humanitarian aid ship bound for Bahrain from leaving the port at Basra. Activists and doctors aboard the vessel launched a protest. One spoke to Press TV.
God is our hope. We ask our president to allow this ship to leave because this vessel carries a message of love and peace.
The ship, sponsored by Iraq's National Committee for the Support of People in Bahrain, also carries food aid and medical supplies sufficient to set up a field hospital. In Syria, state news claimed today that as many as 120 government forces and civilians were killed in one northwest town and that locals there are begging the army to help. Rights groups reported earlier that at least 35 people died in the same town in a weekend crackdown. And the death toll from Friday's violence in Hama is up to at least 65. The cycle of protests, deaths, funerals, and crackdowns on mourners continues unabated as the opposition calls for the ouster of President Bashar al-Assad. International media remains barred from the country and unable to verify ground reports. Celebrations continue in the streets of Yemen today. Vice President Abdelrab Mansour al-Hadi remains in charge after President Ali Abdullah Saleh sought medical care in Saudi Arabia over the weekend. Saleh was injured in an attack on his compound on Friday. He could return in a matter of days, but it's unclear in what role. Last week, Egypt announced the opening of its border with Gaza. This week, Palestinians trying to cross at Rafah are finding it not as open as they had hoped. Rami Al-Maghari reports.
Egyptian authorities have put a number of restrictions in place. They set up a panel to review medical referral documents for patients needing care. They are letting students cross, but only those enrolled at Egyptian universities. And they are only allowing a few hundred Gazan travelers to cross each day. Hamas's spokesperson, Dr. Hassan Abu Hashish, said today that some 10,000 Gazans are waiting to cross the border.
We are calling on our brothers in the Egyptian leadership to stay committed to their decision to ease travel restrictions.
The Gazan government closed their side of the border today in a protest. Palestinians hope that reopening the Rafah terminal will significantly ease the Israeli blockade enforced on Gaza since June 2007. Rami Al-Maghari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
Mexican federal police raided the office of a prominent human rights center in Ciudad Juarez last night. Shannon Young has the details.
Five truckloads of federal police burst into the office of the Paso del Norte Human Rights Center in Ciudad Juarez Sunday, destroying locks and breaking glass. The police searched through file cabinets and computers without presenting a warrant. The Human Rights Center, run by Catholic priest Oscar Enriquez, is participating in a peace caravan currently en route to Ciudad Juarez. The caravan began on Saturday in the city of Cuernavaca. Led by poet Javier Cecilia, the group will make multiple stops in cities affected by drug war violence and impunity. They plan to arrive in Juarez on Thursday, where participants will sign an agreement that sets forth the concrete goals of an emerging anti-drug war movement. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
The U.S. Supreme Court sent an immigration case back to an appeals court today and ordered they review it in light of precedent recently set in an Arizona matter. Two local laws in Hazleton, Pennsylvania are at issue. The first makes it illegal to hire undocumented immigrants, the second to rent them housing. Both are already illegal under federal law, but the Hazleton statutes, like those upheld in Arizona, would penalize business owners and landlords. But the justices sided with undocumented immigrants in a California case today when they upheld in-state tuition rates for those who attend at least 3 years of high school in the state and graduate. Public comment closes at midnight tonight on the nearly 1,700-mile leg of a pipeline that, if completed, would stretch from the tar sands of Alberta to the U.S. Gulf Coast. The controversial Trans-Canada Keystone XL portion would carry diluted bitumen from Oklahoma to the Texas coast. Over the weekend, the U.S. approved Trans-Canada's plan to reopen the first half of the pipeline. It was shuttered after leaking twice in May. For more information, visit keystonepipeline-xl.state.gov. And hundreds of marchers in West Virginia began a 50-mile trek today, calling for an end to mountaintop removal mining. They'll walk the route that as many as 15,000 coal miners followed in 1921 on their march to Blair Mountain. The march ended in an armed battle between miners and henchmen hired by Big Coal. For Free Speech Radio News from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
Thanks for, to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at fsrn.org. I'm Iqbal Ahmed.
And I'm Martin Lemlin. In campus news, the Big Bang is a popular theory among those bound by the laws of reason. And now, thanks to a group of Canadian-led scientists, we're closer than ever to unraveling the mysteries of our universe. A team of international scientists, including Andrea Gutierrez and Walter Hardy from UBC, have managed to hold antimatter atoms for an astounding 16 minutes. Now, this is a remarkable feat considering the previous record for holding antimatter was set last November at less than 1/5 of a second. The collision of matter with antimatter is thought to be the basis of the entire universe. When matter collides with antimatter, they are annihilated the moment they come into contact with each other, producing pure energy. This is what is believed to have happened during the Big Bang. The problem is that our world is made up almost entirely of matter, so even the containers we make to hold antimatter would destroy it instantly. Because of this, any antimatter we're able to produce is typically annihilated as soon as it's created. That is, until this last November, when a team of scientists reported that they'd been able to hold onto the antiatoms for nearly a fifth of a second. Taking advantage of a weak magnetic charge found inside each atom, they were able to suspend the antiparticle in a magnetic field and keep it from touching the walls of the container. This latest achievement, though, to trap the antimatter for a staggering 1,000 seconds, is a great step towards experimenting with and learning about the forces that may have spawned our existence.
In national news, residents of Slave Lake are being asked to sign waivers before returning to their properties. Those who lost their homes in the recent wildfire have ripped through the township of Slave Lake are being asked by the municipality to sign a waiver that absolves the town of responsibility if someone gets sick or injured. According to the town, these are meant to warn residents of the potential dangers of debris, as well as possible environmental contaminations. These waivers will stay in place until the latest soil samples taken by the province of Alberta are analyzed. The province has already analyzed early soil samples, but officials are carefully going over the results before sharing them with the public. Nearly 400 properties were destroyed by the blaze and another 50 damaged, effectively leveling a third of Slave Lake, including the town hall, government center, and library. It's already been a devastating year for Alberta with regards to wildfires. The province has seen nearly 600 wildfires this year, which have ravaged more than 500,000 hectares of land. There are still 32 fires burning in Alberta today, two of which are still out of control. BC so far has been lucky. We have only had 3 active fires as of this morning. The largest was discovered on Saturday at Blue River.
In international news, over 100 police officers were reportedly killed in Syria, but it seems difficult to confirm these things. According to Syria's Information Ministry, 40 security officers were killed today, and 80 more have died since Friday. The officers were apparently responding to calls for help from residents and were killed in an ambush and an explosion at the post office in the northern town of Jisar al-Shagur. But outside media are banned from covering the Syrian uprising, making it nearly impossible to verify such claims. Syrian security forces have been conducting operations in the northern town for several days now in an effort to crack down on anti-government protests. The government is saying that there are armed groups roaming the street and that their security forces are up against hundreds of armed gangs, while activists and protesters emphasize that these protests are peaceful. Arguments are heated as to whether or not activists and protesters are attacking security forces recently. Protesters claim that Syrian television, which is the only news agency allowed to cover the Syrian uprising, is against the activists, and that there's a massive gap with regards to what's happening in the media and what's actually happening in the streets.
In national news, Canada Post and the union representing its employees continue to wrestle for a new collective agreement. Today, Canada Post turned down the latest contract offer that's put up by the union, CUPW, saying it would cost too much, which means the rotating strikes that began last week will continue until the two parties can find some common ground. Last Thursday, the CUPW tried to put pressure on Canada Post by initiating a rotating strike, where post office workers throughout Canada go on strike for 24 hours, one city at a time. The strike started in Winnipeg, then moved to Hamilton over the weekend. Now Montreal is left without mail service until midnight tonight. The main argument seemed to have changed and flipped throughout the negotiating process. Now Canada Post has agreed to withdraw one of its key proposals to increase the number of part-time workers, but is still pressing on the CUPW to implement new technological advances. While the union says it's not opposed to modernization, it simply wants to be consulted on how the change is implemented. There is no word yet on which city will be affected by the rotating strikes, but some fear that as negotiations continue and the need to reach a settlement becomes greater, the strikes will move to larger cities.
In international news, Germany is still struggling to find the cause of their recent E. coli outbreak. Yesterday, German officials believed bean sprouts grown in steam barrels were responsible. But today, 23 of the 40 samples taken from the farm that produced the sprouts tested negative for the advanced strain of E. coli bacteria. Lower Saxony State's Agriculture Ministry says that tests are still underway on the other 17 sprout samples. Although the tests came back negative, does not necessarily mean that previous batches weren't contaminated. Before the sprouts, Spanish cucumbers were thought to be the cause of the outbreak. And all this is leaving Germans confused as to what is safe to eat, as the country deals with the deadliest E. coli outbreak in recent history. It started in early May and affected at least 10 other European countries, leaving 22 people dead and over 2,000 sick, many of those suffering from severe kidney complications. The World Health Organization is warning those affected not to take antibiotics, because they can worsen a condition, and to avoid taking anti-diarrhea medication that would stop the bacteria from quickly leaving the body. I also had an opportunity to speak with a professor here at UBC, Dr. Brent Finley, who does a lot of research regarding the E. coli bacteria, and I had a chance to speak with him, and he shed some light on the matter. Here's that conversation for you. To help us understand more about the E. coli bacteria and what's happening in Germany right now, we're joined by Dr. Brent Finley, who is a professor here at UBC. And thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Finley. What exactly is it that the E. coli virus does to the human body?
Well, it's a bacterium, which is a little different than a virus. It means that it can divide on its own, and it's a relative of the normally occurring E. coli that we have in our intestine, but it's had several things added to it that seems to cause this disease. So we know common E. coli we use in the lab all the time for cloning, et cetera. Then there's other kinds of E. coli that cause disease in people, such as E. coli 0157 that causes the hamburger disease. And now there's this new one, which is sort of a hybrid of a couple of other E. coli that cause disease that we now call 0104, and that's what the one in Germany is.
Regarding its ability to morph and make new strains out of itself, is that how big of a hurdle is that in trying to develop some medication to prevent this bacteria from affecting humanity, really?
Yeah, well, what you're seeing is biology in action. I mean, I commonly say the gut is kind of like this genetic microbial internet where they can swap antibiotic-resistant genes and toxins around, and that's constantly occurring. But what's happening here is we've made some new disease that we see in people, so we pick up on it and then zoom in on it, shall we say. So this happens all the time. This is just normal biology, but the creation of new toxins and new strains triggers new diseases, and that's what we're seeing. So from a therapeutic prevention point of view, there's always new microbial strains arising. We see this also with viruses such as SARS, et cetera. So it does create problems in terms of research, but that's what keeps us in business as well.
Historically, how long have we been aware about the E. coli? I guess it wouldn't be a virus. You said it's a bacteria.
Right.
Have we known about it for a long time, or is it something
E. coli itself was first cultured back in the late 1800s by Theodore Escherich, was named Escherichia coli after him. So that just happened to be an organism that grew out of his own feces way back when. So it's probably the most studied living microorganism there is in this world. There's been a huge amount of science done on E. coli. The disease-causing E. coli have come along rather later in our understanding, and many of them were started to figure out in the 1950s, and the E. coli 0157 that caused Walkerton and other outbreaks, that was really discovered in the late 1970s. And this E. coli 0104, this German strain, it's a brand new strain. We've never seen it before. And like I say, it's a combination of other strains, but it's really hitting our knowledge of it as of, this week sort of thing. It's a brand new strain.
How different are the strains between one another? Are they like drastically different or vaguely similar?
They're about 80% similar, and that's basically the genetic backbone that says I am E. coli. And the other 20% differences are, toxins and antibiotic-resistant genes and other things that allow it to, say, cause disease or live in a certain place in the environment.
And what conditions do E. coli, do they thrive in? It seems like it would be heated water, considering the Walkerton, and they thought that the steamed bean sprouts were the cause in Germany. I guess that's not the case anymore.
Right. Well, I mean, E. coli is designed, I mean, its main place environment is in mammalian intestines, designed to live there. There's no air inside mammalian intestines, so it can survive without air, but it also can live within air, and that's why we can grow it on plates, etc. So like E. coli 157, it's thought to hang out inside cow intestines, and then they defecate in the environment, and then it gets into food and water through fecal contamination. But in terms of an environmental reservoir, there's no like big pools of this thing out in the environment. It's defecated in the soil, and then other organisms pick it up, like humans, through eating it, and then it lives in more intestines that then reproduces.
So there are traces of the E. coli bacteria in our intestines right now?
Not this 0104 strain, but regular E. coli is just, it's a common inhabitant of your intestine, absolutely. The ones that cause disease are not usually part of your intestines unless you get disease.
Do we have any sort of medication that would help either prevent or even get rid of the E. coli bacteria once it's...
The problem is with these kinds of strains is that when you give antibiotics, you actually blow the bacteria apart and you release more toxins, so you worsen the disease. The one solution that our lab has actually come up with that's being adopted across the country to E. coli 0157, which causes most of the outbreaks, except this most recent one, is we developed a cow vaccine where we vaccinate the cows for pieces of the E. coli 0157. So when the cows actually encounter the live bacterium, it doesn't stick inside the cow, and so it can't shed, so it can't then defecate in the environment or contaminate foods upon processing and slaughter. So that's the only solution that's really out there right now in terms of E. coli 0157.
What are some of the symptoms? How would you know that you'd been infected with the E. coli bacteria?
Well, it's acquired by eating contaminated food or water. We've seen it, for example, with contaminated spinach that was watered in California with water that had cow feces containing 0157 in it. Symptoms start off with intestinal disorder and diarrhea and pain, etc. And these can then progress to much more bloody diarrhea, which then in some cases then progresses even worse into kidney failure, which is what we call hemolytic uremic syndrome, which is a very serious disease where it can kill you or cause long-term kidney damage. Now, not everyone that gets the initial diarrhea goes on to that full-blown serious disease, but that is an option that can happen.
The kidney failure you talked about, that's something that's happening in Germany right now, isn't it? There's about 600 cases of the 2,000 that are ill.
Right, and the weird part is that the 2,000 are ill. Normally, it's about 10% or so that go on to this hemolytic uremic syndrome, or HUS. So the large number of the HUS people in Germany is surprising. That's higher than we usually see. And yes, these are all people that are in severe kidney issues. Often you go into renal shutdown, and dialysis is used until either you die or reach stasis or get better.
With the German, do you have any maybe guesses? Because it must be coming from the food, the E. coli outbreak in Germany, right?
Yeah, so data points to, you know, produce of some kind, be it initially with cucumbers and bean sprouts. So that argues it's contamination of soil containing E. coli and then gets into produce, which is not cooked, which then causes a problem. So my guess is there's probably an environmental reservoir. It might be an animal or something that has defecated and causing this collection in the soil. And then when the vegetables are harvested from it, they're contaminated. And then we don't cook them and then eat them, and then we get the disease.
So assuming that the vegetables were cooked properly, this would theoretically, the bacteria couldn't thrive in that atmosphere.
Theoretically, cooking kills it. The problem is these things have a very low infectious dose of, you know, just 5 to 10 microbes, for example. So, you know, even when you're preparing with 0157, preparing hamburgers on a cutting board and, you know, making salad after that, et cetera, it's pretty easy to get contamination. But yes, I mean, first and foremost, good cooking practice goes a long ways to decreasing this organism.
With your research with the E. coli bacteria, what is the process of your actual examination of the bacteria?
Well, what we work on is trying to figure out what makes it tick and how does it work. So we, you know, we can knock particular genes out and ask what's the effect of that on, say, causing disease. We can go in and look at, you know, maybe new strategies for preventing the disease, such as vaccine development, et cetera. So, you know, with the sequence being out, we now know pretty much, well, what's in this organism, and then there's experiments to be done to see whether this is, you know, a key part of this organism causing disease or not. And that's kind of the research we do.
How many strains are there? Is there, like, a multitude, or is it fairly narrow?
Fairly narrow in terms of causing outbreaks. The vast majority of outbreaks are caused by E. coli 0157, and that's the one that caused Walkerton. It's caused the spinach outbreak in the U.S. Contaminated ground beef recalls all the time. This 0104 is a new strain. We have not seen this before, and so whether this then goes on to cause many outbreaks or whether it's just an isolated incident that then goes away, time will tell.
We don't really know of a history that of continuous outbreaks, right? They've been more or less isolated throughout.
Yeah, the way these work is they flare up and then fade away again. And so, I mean, hopefully the German one will start to wane soon and it'll start to fade away. But then it might have contaminated something that, you know, comes back next year in another form.
When it wanes, would it be the human body sort of adapting to the
infection? It would be human avoidance of contaminated food or water once they identify the source. We don't get very good at fighting these things off.
Is there anything else that I may have missed that you think would be integral in knowing about the E. coli bacteria?
No, I think emphasize, you know, good food practice and boil water advisories kind of thing if you're going to Germany. And
All right. Well, thank you very much for speaking with us, Dr. Finley. I appreciate it.
Sure. Right. Okay.
Have a nice day.
You too. Bye.
Dr. Brent Finley is a professor in the Michael Smith Laboratories and the Departments of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology here at the University of British Columbia. For CITR News, I'm Martin Lemelin.
Thank you for that interview, Martin. And to continue with our headlines, in national news, the majority conservative government introduced its new budget today. Although the 374-page document is almost identical to the spring budget which triggered this past election, there are two significant changes. The biggest of which is a $2.2 billion transfer to Quebec to underwrite the province's shift to the harmonized sales tax, a move promised in the conservative campaign. The second is a $300 million increase to the guaranteed income supplement for low-income seniors. So if this gets passed, starting July 1st, this amounts to a $50 increase per senior. Another key feature of the conservative budget has moved up the timetable for balancing the federal budget. They now hope to erase the federal deficit by 2015, a year earlier than previously expected. This ambitious goal will attempt to cut $4 billion a year from government spending. Finance Minister Jim Flaherty promised a new committee of cabinet ministers that will find these savings through a, quote, strategic operating review, end quote. Flaherty went on to say that this will be the first time the federal government has conducted such an extensive review of its operations in over 15 years. Opponents say that this move will lead to deep and painful cuts to government programs, which many Canadians rely on the programs and for employment. For more on the budget, we go to an interview I, Iqbal Abed, conducted earlier today with Mark Lee of the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. Hello, Mike, can you hear me?
Yes.
Great, so thank you for being here with us today. And I guess, first off, can you just give us some background on this budget?
Sure. So this is the a retabling of the budget that led to the last federal election.
Mm-hmm.
And even though it's been a couple of months since, it pretty much is the same budget that was tabled back in March.
Mm-hmm.
There are two new items of note. One is about $2 billion that's going to Quebec for being part of the HST regime, even though
mm-hmm.
Quebec joined back in 1991 when the GST first came in. This was basically an election goodie to win votes in Quebec. That's
mm-hmm.
what they promised, and they are now delivering on in the budget. And the other new thing is the removal of public federal support for political parties. So the what used to be a certain amount per vote, each party got a public subsidy. That has been removed largely on political grounds. It's a political benefit to the Conservatives to do that and undercuts some of the support going to the Liberals and NDP.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that this transfer to Quebec, he hopes to gain some gains in the coming election? Is this a political move?
Well, the appeal of it during the election campaign was to win votes in Quebec. Obviously, that failed dramatically, and the shift in Quebec went to the NDP. But so they're just delivering on a promise that was made back then. So, in a sense, it's a sort of a status quo budget. There are kind of like, track changes in Microsoft Word, where they've got a few changes in blue from the previous version. Overall, it's a budget that is not the radical hard right shift that some folks like myself were concerned about, but it is a troublesome budget in that it sets up a context of public sector cuts at the federal level over the next few years, largely to finance corporate income tax cuts.
Mm-hmm. And this is the strategic operating review that Finance Minister Jim Flaherty was discussing?
Yeah, the federal government has been in various strategic program reviews going back to when Paul Martin was prime minister in the 1990s. So there's been a lot of cuts already to the federal public service.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of a continuation on that same pattern. And they are seeking some fairly ambitious cuts. Looking at about $4 billion per year in cuts to the federal departments.
Mm-hmm.
My colleagues back in Ottawa estimate that could be up to 80,000 jobs that are lost as a result of those cuts. So they're not small, and it's not obvious where those cuts are going to be made just yet. They'll be happening kind of over the course of the next couple years as the Treasury Board under Tony Clement basically examines every single program in the federal arsenal.
Do you think they'll be able to make these budget cuts without, too much disturbance to the way Canada's operating?
There's to some extent, there are people who are retiring and then you just don't replace their positions. So those are kind of easier cuts to be made. But even if you factor those in, you're still looking at, an additional $40,000 jobs that would be cut. Mm-hmm. In order to meet that target. So we'll see how things go, but certainly that's a pretty a gloomy prospect at a time when the economy isn't doing particularly well. The overall international environment is not that favorable given what's happening in the United States and Europe and Japan. Oil prices are pretty high. The Bank of Canada is talking about raising interest rates in the fall. So if a downsizing exercise in Ottawa piled on top of that is only going to be a bad thing for Canada's economy.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed another thing included in this new budget, well, I guess revised budget, in a sense, is an increase to the amount of money that will be going to low-income seniors. And do you think this is something that the Harper government might have done, as in kind of including the criticisms from the last budget, leveled especially from the NDP?
Well, I think this was a measure that was brought in the original budget, and it was, I think, kind of a teaser to try to get some support from the NDP. It's a good thing to increase the transfers to low-income seniors. Canada has overall done a pretty good job compared to most industrialized countries in terms of dealing with poverty among seniors, and this is targeted money that adds to the maximum amount that low-income seniors can get. It works out to about, $50 per eligible person. So it's not a huge amount of money, but certainly anything at that level is a good thing and will make a difference. So that's one of the positives in the budget. Another one is some additional financing for the what's called the Eco-Energy Home Retrofit Program, which is designed to, improve the energy efficiency of households. And there's a few small spending items, and there's a few kind of smattering of tax changes in there. You know, those are, some of them are good, some of them are, you know, not really that interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But really the big story in the budget that's not really highlighted in the budget at all is the fact that the government's pushing ahead with major cuts and, you know, being essentially financed by cuts to the overall public sector.
Mm-hmm. One of the more, I guess, talked about parts of the budget is the elimination of, like, the subsidy for political parties. And how do you think this might affect the way politics are run in Canada in the future?
Well, I mean, you know, we had a system in Canada where political parties didn't get that funding. It was the Chrétien government that mm-hmm. Brought it in, you know, what, maybe 12 or 13 years ago. And, you know, we don't have that here in BC. It's not necessarily a huge amount of money in total. Like, you wouldn't really notice it in the mm-hmm. context of the overall federal budget. I think there's an argument to be made that it does mean that, you know, political parties aren't, you know, reliant on donations and get some funding from, you know, the general public purse.
Mm-hmm.
In order to, and that kind of levels the playing field somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
But whether that funding has actually been effective and how much it levels the playing field, you know, I'm not totally convinced that
mm-hmm.
it's done so. So, yeah, I'm kind of on the fence around the political party money.
As you're saying that this really isn't that big of a change from the overall context of the budget, why do you think he made this cut?
Oh, well, you know, I think from Harper's perspective, they the Conservatives raise a lot more money
mm-hmm.
from individuals and corporations than any other political party. So this just strengthens the Conservative advantage in fundraising. Although, you know, it may mean that the NDP and Liberals now have to, you know, redevelop their sense of populism
mm-hmm.
in order to attract more grassroots support for their party. So, you know, this may be one of those things that 10 years down the road people on the left think is as a good thing, but it's really hard to say right now.
Mm-hmm. Any last thoughts?
Not really. You know, I guess having seen a lot of federal and provincial budgets
mm-hmm.
Over the years, anytime we have a budget that's not a complete bloodbath,
mm-hmm.
I'm pleased. But it's not a great budget, and you know, I think there's a really big concern in terms of how this plays out in the public sector and what this means for services that the Canadians rely on, or a lot of the regulatory functions that the federal government does, which have already been really cut back. So, you know, the next time we see a nationwide E. coli outbreak, you know, this is going to be part of it, the fact that we no longer have this sort of inspection of meat and other
mm-hmm.
products. So even though regulations may be on the books, they're not being enforced because we don't have the eyes and ears of civil servants on the ground. This
mm-hmm.
is what we've discovered in BC with all of the budget cuts we've had here and already federally. So, you know, piling on billions of dollars in cuts suggests to me that we're going to have a really shriveled public sector when it comes out to looking out for the public
mm-hmm.
interest.
Interesting. Actually, just one last thing. Are you surprised on how, like I said, this wasn't as right-wing as people thought it would be? Did this catch a lot of people by surprise?
Well, for me, my concern was that Harper would use the opportunity to bring in a really kind of revolutionary budget and,
mm-hmm.
and impose, you know, dramatic cuts and changes to the way the federal government operates right out of the gate, and then hoping that people will have forgotten by the time the next election rolls around.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that he's sticking pretty much to what was tabled when they are in minority is so far a good sign, although, as I mentioned, there are some major problems with the budget. But we'll see how this all unfolds over the next, you know, 6 months to a year.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thank you for joining us today.
Okay, thanks, Iqbal.
Yeah, have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for that, Iqbal. In a minute, we're going to have your weekday weather forecast. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, right here in Vancouver, broadcasting from the Student Union Building on campus at the University of British Columbia.
Are you interested in radio, but not quite sure how to get involved? CITR is the place for you. We are a volunteer-driven campus and community radio station with a variety of volunteer opportunities. Want to become an on-air programmer? Learn about promotions? Maybe become a news or arts reporter? Come learn about all the ways you can become involved at CITR. Volunteer orientations are held on the first Monday of every month at 6:30 p.m. If the first Monday falls on a statutory holiday, the orientation moves to the second Monday. Visit CITR.ca for more information.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting out of the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. Now we go to your weekday weather forecast with esteemed not meteorologist Martin Lemlin.
Well, I try my best. It's been a beautiful couple of days here in Vancouver, and I'm sorry to tell you that it doesn't look as though it's going to keep on going. Tonight, it's going to drop to 12 degrees with building clouds, and we're going to see a little bit of rain tomorrow afternoon, 60% chance of showers at 17 degrees, and it's going to continue on to Wednesday, although it will be a little bit warmer, peaking almost near 20 degrees, but still a good chance of rain. Thursday and Friday, it's going to be cloudy with around 19, 18 degrees, but might not see rain. Saturday, more of the same in 20 degrees. Sunday, the sunshine should peak up again, which brings us back to Monday for another beautiful edition of CITR News 101. That is your weekday weather forecast, and I'm Martin Lemlin.
Thank you, Martin. We're going to take another quick PSA break, but we'll be right back.
You know, Joe, you start with these riffs in your head.
We're good.
And something you want to say, and you want to spin gold, but the thing is, people don't want your sounds. They only want...
You people, you're the fucking coolest!
Just fucking use you. You know what I'm saying, Joe?
What is that? What is it? One more shot? A salute?
Tune in to Sore Throats and Clapping Hands, hosted by Robert Privet, Monday evenings at 6:30 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And in the end, it's love. And in the end, it's love. And in the end, it's love.
Machines without being hassled by the man. Yeah, 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 yeah. And we want to get loaded.
Yeah. On Fridays from 1 till 2 p.m., prepare to get your jeans dirty. Join me, Bobby the Badger Ferris, for the greasier side of rock and roll, rhythm and blues, and country. From Hank to the helicopters, from Otis to the Oblivions, it's the perfect way to slither into your weekend.
We won't talk about the habits, just the music and the man.
That's the Barn Burner every Friday from 1 till 2 p.m. only on CITR 101.9.
Welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. This is News 101, and I'm Iqbal Ahmed. And now we go to Robert Holmes, who will be talking to us about the BC Poverty Reduction Act. Hi, Robert, are you there?
Yeah, sure. How are you doing?
Great, how are you?
Fine.
Great. Well, I guess first things first, can you tell us what is the BC Poverty Reduction Act and kind of the background behind it?
I suppose I could. Reduction Act. I thought we were talking about the elections stuff, but...
That might have been a miscommunication,
yeah.
But actually, what is it that you would like to talk about now that you're here?
Well, we issued a press release today dealing with the fact that the Quebec legislature had said that they were demanding that they get no less than 24% of the seats in the House of Commons.
Okay.
On a perpetual basis, and that is something that sort of doesn't square with what we have to say, because the obvious representation by population rule is something that's embedded in the Constitution, and so we chimed in with a number of other groups and with Western Canadian and Ontario leaders who've said that no, you should get seats based upon the population percentage that you have, and if you go below the level that you had last time, well, then there should be a reduction. If you go up, then you should get more. Because the proposal that's being put on the table, and was in the last parliament but wasn't voted on, was that 30 additional seats get created. I think Ontario is to get 18, BC 7, and Alberta 5. Mm-hmm. And Quebec obviously looks at that and says that they were not as impressed with that idea, because having 75 seats out of 308 is more powerful than 75 seats out of 338. Mm-hmm. But regardless, if the population figures are such as to generate that kind of a result, then that's the way things should be, because democracy is based upon one person, one vote, not one province, one vote.
Mm-hmm. And I guess those who would be sympathetic to Quebec's cause would say that as the only Francophone province in Canada, that them having this number of seats will keep them from being singled out or ostracized from the political process. What is your response to this?
Well, Quebec has its own province, and it's put in place special laws to deal with preservation of French culture and the French language within Quebec, and those have, in some measure at least, been upheld by the courts as fitting within the Constitution, although I think they're in some respects, they have gone perhaps overboard, because they have put, I think, the only time that a province has used the notwithstanding clause in the Constitution to ensure that notwithstanding what charter rights people have, that some laws in Quebec as to language and culture would be upheld. But provincial legislation can protect an awful lot, and the voice of a provincial government is heard in Ottawa, especially one of the larger provinces like Quebec. But it doesn't end up making for a basis for diverging from the rule that is embedded in the Constitution ever since 1867. It said that even Parliament can't tinker with the principle of proportionate representation amongst the provinces, and I think everybody who is a committed and true Democrat would agree with that. If we were running this country like the United Nations does, then we'd see nothing amiss with having China, India, the United States, or other populist countries get just one vote, and Liechtenstein and Andorra and a number of other small countries with very small populations get one vote as well. But the UN doesn't tax anybody. The UN can only recommend things that nation states then get to decide whether or not they're going to adhere to or not. Just like making treaties, the approach to making treaties. Mm-hmm. But where you have governments that are not sort of top-down, but rather people-controlled, in a democratic system and a democratic principle, like Canada is supposed to be, then the idea of giving any one particular group more say than their population merits, more seats in the House of Commons than their population merits, is simply not on. And it's important to remember what we're talking about, which is the House of Commons, which is supposed to be representative of the people, and in a very real sense, you would, in my view at least, erode the confidence of the population in the representative nature of the House of Commons even more if you were to start tinkering with the level of representation that any one province was to get, especially a bigger province. Mm-hmm. I mean, we do have rules in place. For example, we have a quirky rule that says you can't have fewer MPs than you have senators, which protects little provinces like Prince Edward Island from having fewer MPs than they have senators. They have four. Mm-hmm. But one can see some, at least marginal rationale for something like that, because having four voices in the House of Commons is, in an institution that size, still likely to be something that would get lost in the shuffle. And if they only had one, which is what their population entitles them to, then
Hello? I think we just lost Mr. Robert Holmes. I'm going to take a quick PSA and we'll be right back.
Some merit. He creates this outcry, this clamor. He creates this nightmare of noise.
If it makes noise, it has some merit.
He's a sonic mess, basically. The discordant notes are just a hubbub, a cacophony.
If it makes noise, it has some merit.
He creates a disturbance because he's basically disturbed.
If it makes noise, it has some merit.
Basically, this is a worthless racket. The man is mentally incompetent.
For the most ear-splitting forays into noise, prog, early industrial, no wave, plunderphonic, psych, and altogether way out sound, tune into A Noise with your host Luke Meat every Wednesday from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM.
Solo the guitar, guitar solo.
A Noise, music that isn't in its right mind.
This is my life. I wake up in the morning, I eat, I sleep, I shit.
Breakfast with the Browns.
Sure, whatever it is, but I never shut it off for 5 minutes.
I can't wait to impress my friends with my astounding knowledge of cool.
Join your favorite Brownsters and tune in and listen to the best selection of down-tempo electro-pop lounge core.
Strictly Squaresville.
Remember, subtle, basic, Brown.
Breakfast with the Browns
on CITR 101.9 FM every Monday morning
from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m.
The older I get, the more life starts to make sense and the less I care.
Now we're riding the rainbow, the clouds lift, and we're making it like young. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville, and we're making it like him. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville.
You know, you can give 100 examples of what it isn't, but you, man, you're gonna have a hell of a time saying what it is.
Just in, Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock, CITR 101.9 FM presents Cabba Radio. Join host Teddy Smooth as he explores the chimerical, the hysterical, the phantasmagorical world of burlesque and cabaret. Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock, CITR 101.9 FM brings you Cabba Radio.
And that's our program for June 6, 2011. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments and get involved with the show, give us a hot news tip, please contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email us at news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITRNews, or you can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. For more news, join us next Monday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Martin Lumlin from the entire news team here at CITR. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Sore Throats Clapping Hands at 6 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.